Part 2, The Edge of Hell. The ferryman demanded we pay the price of freedom. We paid as everyone must pay, in coin of flesh, of soul, of blood, of life. We paid, we gambled, our future. But it must be this way. Sacrifices must matter, don't you see? A sacrifice is only true if it drains the giver and nourishes the taker. So we gave, and the ferryman took, and we were lessened, and they were enriched. From the Infinity Canticle, sequestered by the holy order of His Imperial Majesty's Inquisition as an ultima-grade moral threat, purported to be the unedited raving confession of Sargon Eregesh, Lord Prelate of the Black Legion. Chapter 8. Outrunning the Storm. The first ship to die was the Inviolate. It was a Terran-born destroyer, one of the oldest vessels in our fleet, and one of the most reliable. It had sailed the skies in the very earliest years of the Great Crusade, and though it was originally sworn to the Seventh Legion, the Sons of Horus had wrested it from the Imperial Fist's masters during the Siege of Terra. Its current captain, the former Sons of Horus Reaver chieftain, Zerakan Kovis, was a calm and calculating officer with a gift for void battle. The Inviolate itself was a beautiful vessel, a spearpoint cutter of a warship, swift and lethal. It exploded after 11 minutes and 9 seconds of redlining instruments and warning klaxons, the stress upon its hull too much to bear. I watched it happen. I listened to the final calls of its command crew, laced with interference across the fleet-wide vox. The Inviolate buckled off course, falling out of alignment with the fleet tumbling into the seething tides of fiery warp energy that thrashed and boiled around our armada. I saw it enveloped in those dissolving waves, its shields bursting as it plunged into them. I saw the ship's hull first crumple, crushed by the grip of impossible pressures, then come apart, pulled open as though it were nothing more than a child's toy. I felt the Inviolate's sorcerer pilot's final thoughts, the split-second desperation of, "Wait! Wait!" that he unintentionally breathed into the burning night. I felt no fear from him. Perhaps he believed he could still maintain control in that flash-fire second before he was bathed in the cascading energies of unreality. Whatever the truth, the mundanity of the sentiment was a breed of madness in its own right. The refusal of consciousness to realize its end has come. Rarely do we sound so human, but death perhaps is the great equalizer. "The Inviolate has fallen," Ultio called out across the bridge. Her voice betrayed her distraction as she faced forwards, floating in her immense life support tank. Her crown of cognitive interface tendrils swayed in the fluid between the young woman and the hive of gestalt brain engines fixed to the chamber's ceiling above her. Her eyes were narrowed to slits, her teeth clenched, her outreaching hands curled into claws of effort. She wore an expression she had never worn in life, a rictus of such inhuman ferocity that it momentarily drew my eyes away from the oculus. Blood was beginning to stain the fluid close to her body, curling into the aqua vitriolo in misty, sanguine threads from cuts appearing across her flesh. Around her, around all of us, the bridge was a red-stained place of fear scent and thunder. Abaddon clutched the handrail at the edge of his raised dais, his golden gaze locked to the storm, kaleidoscoping outside the ship. The vengeful spirit juddered in its entirety. We heard its central spinal stanchions growl, then whine in the storm's grip. At the bridge's heart, the anamnesis cried out in sympathetic pain. The din of the vox rivaled the tempest tearing us apart. The voices of every captain in the fleet cried out in disordered unity, reporting their progress and roaring of stress fractures, of failing shields, of shipboard fires and uncountable deaths. I could hear space around us, the void itself shrieking with the outpouring of souls dragged from dying bodies. Our fleet was populating the warp with the spirits of our slain. We led the way. The vengeful spirit took the brunt of the tempest's tide, a wavebreaker vanguard that ploughed through the roughest thrashings of energy, shattering them to carve a route through for the smaller ships. New trails of blood inked the amniotic fluid from a fresh latticework of wounds across Ultio's body. She suffered as the ship suffered. The promise of absolution was a jagged silhouette off our port bow, another of the forward battleships spearing ahead to take the worst of the boiling tides. One moment it was there, shaking and streaming fire from its battlemented hull. The next it was a lacerated hulk, killed too swiftly to even detonate. Torn apart sections of the ship tumbled away into the warp's devouring essence. It was as if the entire ship had crumbled as part of an avalanche. We did not even hear any change in their final communications. One moment the captain was there, the next his voice was no longer present in the Voxweb. Delvaris was next to me, his boots magnetically locked to the deck, his gauntleted hands holding to the same crew rail as mine. He was second-born, the melange of demonic entity and human soul, and as ever in his presence I felt the war taking place inside him, the eternal shifting turmoil between possessor and possessed. His eyes were blackened orbs in his dark flesh, curdled over with etheric cataracts, and though the warp had rendered him blind, it had suffused his other senses with sensitivity beyond measure. When the promise of absolution died, his face twitched as if in pain, though I knew it was far more likely hunger.
Was that the absolution?
His voice was a raised snarl. I could feel the need within him, the feverish desire to adopt what he and his brethren called the war shape, letting the demon threaded through his flesh ascend to the fore in the hour of bloodshed. He fought the instinct, just as he fought the bite of the butcher's nails in his brain. It was, I sent back, telepathy far more reliable than shouting amid so many other voices. He twitched again, this time in true pain, at his cranial implants reacting to the unwanted touch of my silent voice.
There were almost 2,000 warriors on that ship,
he said between clenched teeth. He didn't mention the tens of thousands of slaves, serfs, thralls, and servitors. But even noting the loss of our brethren was a sentiment I had never expected from Delvaris, of all men. He said more, but the vengeful spirit kicked around us as it pounded through another devastating wave, casting the deck into flickering darkness for several seconds and intensifying the warning sirens. Ultio screamed again, her voice razoring from the shouting mouths of 100 gargoyles and fallen angels. The ship cried out with her, from its ram to its roaring engines, its superstructure groaning with torment. As that jewel cry rang through our minds, I looked up to Ashokai. He stood on his navigational platform above the bridge, eyes wide, long hair like a banner in the grip of a storm's wind. He was braced, as we were all braced, though he saw none of us. His sight was tuned to the realm outside the ship, and his hands on the twin control columns sent impulses and commands to Ultio and to the vengeful spirit itself. I'd never seen Ashokai and the Anamnesis move in such perfect synchronicity, their motions mirrored, each lean and tilt and adjustment coming in the very same second for both sorcerer and living machine spirit. Even their injuries were in sympathy. The psi stigmata that decorated Ultio's flesh showed across Ashokai's face in the same constellations of ripping pain. Three of those slashes tore open to the bone. Only when the ship crashed through the most forceful tides did they fall out of alignment, and Ashokai's pale features would strain with the effort of finding that slipped harmony once more. The vengeful spirit was Ultio's ship. Thanks to the Mechanicum's ingenuity, she was far more aware and attuned to her vessel than most machine spirits could ever be. But it was Ashokai, her void guide, who saw the way through the storm. If there was a way through this one.
I do not believe there is.
Evidently he had heard my careless thoughts. The next ship to die was one of the nameless bulk cruisers that carried clans of beastmen warriors and warp-changed human slave soldiers. Its death lit the Oculus as it veered wildly off course, rolling into the acidic tides either side of the turbulent channel we were carving, and a migraine crack of light flared sun-bright for half a heartbeat. A fraction of a moment later it was gone. All that remained were the echoes of its captain's screams over the Voxweb. Three of Ultio's Vox gargoyles toppled from the gothic rafters and shattered into marble rubble across the deck. Another, one of the bronze sculptures, with its features twisted in ecstatic agony, crashed onto one of the crew consoles with the sound of a great bell tolling, killing two humans and crippling a third. I made my way to Abaddon, forced to move as a drunkard might across the shaking bridge and staggering over the corpses of the storm slain. I gripped his shoulder guard, forcing him to face me. His face was his father's face, red lit by the emergency illumination, flashing with the colours of madness that danced outside the dying ship. "We will not survive this," I sent directly into his mind. "The spirit cannot endure this punishment. We must break through," he spat back through his filed teeth. "We will break through." And then, with the ever-surprising force of his own will, he spoke right into my mind. "I will not die in this prison, Iskandar. I will be free. We will all be free. We will bring our fury to the Golden Throne itself, and the husk enshrined there will weep with the homecoming of his abandoned angels." I met his eyes for what felt like an eternity, though I know it cannot have been more than a brief moment. Blood of the Pantheon, but he looked like his father then. The creature before me was Horus, in body and blood. The only difference was the eyes. Horus had been hollowed through by the powers he had sought and failed to control. Abaddon was drained by forever resisting them. The father had been but a host for the strength of others. The son was a bastion of his own will and endurance. I saw then, truly and for the very first time, just what value my lord could be to the creatures we call gods. "What do you see, Iskandar?" I snapped back to the reality of our flagship burning, shattering around us. "What?" "Outside the ship. Do you see their hands at work?" Abaddon knew none of my internal revelations. He wanted me to spread my senses beyond the warship's hull. Were we being held here? Was this hurricane the whim of the malevolent consciousnesses that acted through the galactic wound we called the Eye? I cast my perceptions wide, breaking through the walls of the vengeful spirit, plunging into the firestorm of warp energy. I felt the cataclysm of forces at work, the shoving rage of our engines generating an equal pushback in the Eye's resistant tides. I saw our armada drifting apart, unable to hold cohesion in the chaos. I saw demons, a billion demons, a trillion demons, riding and leaping and melting out of the warp matter to burst, laughing, howling, clawing against our warship's hulls. "Iskandar!" I opened my eyes to my lord's face once more. Sparks sprayed elsewhere across the command deck. I could smell burning fur and sizzling blood. Beastmen cawed and croaked and brayed and bellowed and died. So many of them were dying. "Stop the ship," I said. And though there was no hope of hearing me over the thunder, Abaddon read my lips. "Is it them?" he sent into my mind, fierce as a lance through the skull. I tensed and sought to back away from him, but he held me in place. The truth was that I did not know. Was this a move by the gods in their great game? No one could know such things with certainty. But I know what I sensed outside the ship. "It is us," I sent back. "As we push, the storm pushes back. We push harder, it answers with thunder and acid and pain. Stop the ship! Stop the fleet!" Abaddon released me and turned to the Oculus once more. Fury, absolute in its intensity, blackened his features. "The fleet!" Ultio began, and she needed to say no more. The Oculus finished her thought, showing the shapes of our armada shrinking, falling behind, several more shaking beyond tolerance and beginning to shatter, others engulfed with wrapping shrouds of warp energy. The vengeful spirit gave its most savage heave yet, throwing half of the command crew to the deck. Several crew stations detonated through their links to suffering pressure points elsewhere aboard the ship.
The Blood Knights!
Ultio called out, and her voice became a messy merging of warship names as they fell out of formation in grotesque and swift disorder.
The White Sigil! The Hammer of Sarthas! The Halo Blades! The...
Abaddon screamed. It was a wordless cry of raw emotion, the roar of a thwarted king without the power to protect his crumbling kingdom. Rage laced that cry, as one would surely expect, but there was also frustration. Frustration that others could not provide what he needed of them, and vexation that his plans were being swept aside by the hands of pathetic, accursed gods at this latest of hours.
Oh, stop!
Every warrior and crew member not actively engaged in keeping the ship held together turned to him. Ashrakai was down on one knee now, teeth bared into an invisible gale, his skin lacerated with a thousand cuts that wept tiny trickles of blood.
I can't get us through,
he wheezed across the vox. His lungs sounded full of fluid, most likely blood. The warp was cutting him to pieces along with the ship.
Oh, stop!
Abaddon roared a second time.
Lord, I can...
Abaddon ignored him, his blazing gaze locked on the anamnesis in her suspension tank. His voice was inaudible over the crashing, shaking bridge. All I saw was his mouth moving.
Ultio! Signal the fleet! All stop! All stop!
The protesting, failing ship was riven by new thunder as the engines banked and the retros bawled into life. The shaking, that heaving wrench of abused iron, slowly began to abate. I watched the Oculus' compound eye view of the ships in our armada as they slowed in our wake. The ravaging warp tides eased around them. It took time to slow down, for our thrusters to bring everything into balance and for the warp's angry tides to finally settle. A warship is never silent, nor even truly quiet. Plasma reactors, kilometers away, send their living murmurs through every inch of metal. Crews speak, curse, breathe, shift. Power armor hums as it idles and snarls when its wearers move. The vengeful spirit's command deck was louder than most, with the size of its crew and the anamnesis's life support tank with all its ticking, clicking, ancillary cognition machines. The fleet clustered around us, drawing in close, the way a pack of beasts approaches its alpha, with their throats showing in submission. Abaddon watched them drifting into formation, saying nothing. I could sense the swift cycle of his thoughts, but could discern none of their meaning.
All stop,
Ultio called after what felt like an age. I looked across the bridge at the wounded and the dead, at the smoky aftermath of our failure. We had failed. We were trapped. Ashrakai descended from his platform, boots thudding on the gantry stairs, and knelt before Abaddon. He looked destroyed by his futile efforts, his eyes closed, blood scabbing across the host of psi stigmata lacerations that covered his face and throat.
I tried, Ashrakai.
Blood spattered to the deck by Abaddon's boots, spilled from Ashakai's cut tongue. The warp had wounded him even there.
I tried.
There had been times before this, and there would be more to come, when Abaddon punished failure by execution. Sometimes I must admit these acts were delivered out of unrestrained anger, but more often as acts of calculated and precise mercilessness. To set examples, to establish boundaries, to spread fear, as all tyrants and warlords and kings have done since time began and the first men and women ruled their brothers and sisters. But he is not without forgiveness. He knows when a defeat was unavoidable. That distant day, as our armada sat becalmed in the seas of madness, he barely even looked down at Ashrakai before resting a hand on the other warrior's pauldron and lifting the sorcerer to his feet.
You cannot fight fate, brother. But you did well to try.
That choice of words rekindled life in the sorcerer's red eyes. Shame, yes, but life as well. Something dangerously close to hope.
Is that what you believe this was?
he asked Abaddon.
Fate?
It was Moriana, an insignificant wraith at Abaddon's side, who drew my eye. I felt my irritation rise with the way she stood in Abaddon's shadow, where she alone seemed unbroken. Defeat settled across the rest of us like a cloak. Ashokai and the Anamnesis were riven by warp stigmata, and bodies of mutants lay across the ridge. Yet she was the lone soul showing no unease at our continued imprisonment. She looked almost vindicated, as if this outcome had been a suspicion of hers since we brought her aboard all those weeks before, and here it finally stood confirmed.
Greatness requires sacrifice.
She looked between those of us gathered there, one by one, until her gaze finally settled on Ashokai.
It always requires sacrifice. It is the way of all life. I tried to tell you this, Ezekiel.
He shrugged her off, evidently not as enthralled to her words as we had feared. She drew breath to press her point.
When the time comes, you cannot run from what must be done. Sacrifices must always be made.
Be silent, he warned her. Look around you, prophetess. See the fraying tempers and defeated hearts of those nearby. Now is not the time to weave smug and mystical allusions to the preciousness of hindsight.
Telemachon laughed softly behind his mask, though more in derision at my annoyance than agreement with it. Lahior gave Moriana a disgusted glance before jerking his chin towards Abaddon.
So now what? He asked.
The question hung in the air between us. No one had an answer. In the long-ago Age of Sail, when vessels of wood and cloth rode the oceans of terror at the mercy of weather and wind, there were fewer fates worse than being becalmed. Vessels without the breath of wind in their sails were doomed to drift in the ocean, too far from land for oars to be any salvation. That is the situation we found ourselves in. We were becalmed. To go forwards was to die, while to go back was to abandon all hope of a future. If we could not revenge ourselves upon the Imperium, why then did we band together in this new brotherhood? Why did we still draw breath? Perhaps you think us stubborn. Perhaps you believe we should have turned away and sailed back from whence we came, back to those demon world fortresses and those savage blood raids against our brethren. Perhaps it truly seems that simple to you. But then it would. You have never been free. Freedom, once tasted, cannot be so easily forgotten. Life in the Eye was an existence of hellish, endless battle in the underworld. It has always been our prison and our crucible, as much as our sanctuary. Yet there we sat, motionless in the warp-touched void. There, on the very edge of the Eye, we took stock of our losses. 7 warships lost with all hands, 5 times that number damaged, some grievously. 1,000s of legionaries gone, to say nothing of the mortal and mutant crews, or the priceless arsenals of war gear, gunships and battle tanks also fallen away into oblivion. In that long-ago era, before we had conceived of the Crimson Path, before Abaddon wearied of Cadia and wiped it from existence like excrement from his boot, the only reliable route out of the Great Eye was the so-called Cadian Gate. There, reality cut a deep gouge into eye space and soothed the seething tides. Yet a route out of the eye is useless, if it cannot even be reached in the first place. The worst aspect was that none of us had an answer to Lahior's question. None of us knew what we could do to free the fleet from this etheric stalemate. The answer, when it came, was delivered in the form of destruction. I sensed nothing of the first asteroid. It was too swift for our storm-compromised Auspex scanners to track. We only became aware of it when the troop barge Scarred Crown blared warning cries across the fleet-wide vox web, and by then it was already too late to do anything. The Scarred Crown was already dying, its diminished wreckage rolling and tumbling through space. The asteroid that had slain it had shattered in the impact. I watched a spread of huge rocks, each one streaming fire like a comet's tail, scattering into the misty void of ice space. Ultio closed her eyes, pressing a hand to her temple. She got no further. Another asteroid speared through the fleet, this time killing the Oath of Knives with a heart strike, bursting the cruiser's void shields and driving through its core, triggering a terminal unleashing of plasma that instantly annihilated the entire superstructure. Ultio turned in her blood-streaked fluid tank, hands tensing once more into claws.
"Translation signatures!" she called out,
and then, with her eyes widening,
"Brace! Brace!"
The engines fired, the ship's manoeuvring thrusters igniting along its starboard side. Every single soul aboard the Vengeful Spirit was thrown to the deck as the ship moved from all stop into a hard banking rolling turn, the vessel protesting at the pressures put upon its hull. The third asteroid still hit us. All power failed in the wake of that world-shaking crash. It took several seconds to reactivate, during which time we existed in a shaking, thrashing realm of absolute blackness. When the illumination globes flared back to life, they cast their light over Ultio in her suspension chamber, sigh stigmatic bruises blackening the flesh of her back and shoulders. Blood trailed from her left eye, threading into the amniotic fluid.
"Relighting voids," she mouthed,
as her gargoyles declared the words aloud. The ship stabilized, slowing in its roll.
"Relighting voids. Seeking. Seeking."
On the Oculus, views of ice space clicked through magnification filters as the anamnesis followed the asteroid's trajectories back to their origins. At first, I thought we were witnessing our Armada's shadow cast across the swirling mists of ice space. I realized my error when I saw the vessels moving and more warships penetrating the haze following behind them.
"Shield failure,"
Ultio called out.
"I am unable to rekindle the voids."
Abaddon watched from his central dais, eyes gleaming with vicious captivation. "Ultio, signal the fleet to form a defensive sphere. All warships are to protect the supply runners and troop barges. Run out the guns. All hands prepare for battle."
"Another projectile,"
she warned. "Destroy it." She tried, but she was wounded from the storm, and too few of the Vengeful Spirit's weapons were ready to fire. No matter how swiftly her gestalt mind operated, the calculations for void battle at such insane ranges required time and precision. We had the luxury of neither. Torpedoes sluiced from their chambers, silently cutting the misty darkness of space. Several impacted on the surface of the inbound hunk of planetary rock, but most went wide, running harmlessly onwards. The frigate Skies of Wrath was already moving, rolling aside from the path of its oncoming doom. The asteroid hurtled past, illuminating the ship's voids as it came within sparking distance of the vessel's belly. Around me, the command deck had broken into a miasma of activity. Crews shouted and raced between stations. Legionaries demanded answers. Machinery thrummed and clanked. But I was watching the Oculus, ignoring the jostles I received from standing in the way. I watched the last asteroid spinning away into space after missing the Skies of Wrath. They were more than mere dead rock. They echoed with familiar whispers, familiar cries, as though the asteroids were alive, or had once been. The other fleet approached from the storm, sailing far calmer tides than those we had endured. Whatever forces had oppressed us offered no such resistance to these newcomers. They lingered at the very edge of our firing solutions, at a distance not only invisible to the naked eye, but requiring intensive calculation to even lock weapons. Only their weaponized meteors could reach us. More of them streamed through our spreading formations, but with our ships moving, there was no chance of striking at such a range with unguided projectiles. Only our own complacency and poor luck had allowed the deaths of the Scarred Crown and Oath of Knives. One of the lead battleships ignited with a procession of successive lights along its backbone. Not damage, but a harnessing and release of energy. Another meteor burst forth from beneath the vessel's hull. "They're using mass drivers," I said. Iliaster, pale and parched as ever, stared at the oculus with his sunken gaze. Wearing our legion's black only highlighted his emaciation and cadaverous pallor. He spared me a roomy, unhealthy glance that still blazed with life.
But why?
He asked. I had no idea. They're not even aiming, I replied. The next asteroid speared past us, parting the misty matter of ice space. I felt it again, that murmur of familiar voices. Ceraxia stalked closer to me, her bladed legs clank, clank, clanking on the deck. The dim light of battle stations cast her hooded features into absolute blackness. All I could see of her face was the faintest glint off the edge of one eye lens.
You sense something?
She accused me. Those asteroids. They sound like... They feel like... Like Malium. The same whispers I had heard on that dead world. The same choruses of ghosts. Blood of the gods, I swore, turning and ascending Abaddon's dais. He was watching another fusillade of vast rocks slash past us. Ezekiel, those asteroids. Their mass drivers won't hit us at this range. Not now we're ready for them. I waved his reassurance aside. Those aren't just void rocks. They've shattered the grave world. They're throwing Malium at us. Abaddon spat a curse.
Tagus Daravik.
I could only agree. Leaving our dominion behind had meant sailing far from the reach of our astropathic relays and telemetry beacons. The forces we had left to garrison our territory were pulled tight to the most critical regions, with skeleton fleets and war hosts around our primary fortresses, leaving the rest of our domain at the risk of invasion. We knew this was a risk. We accepted it as necessary. And thus, we had no conception of what was transpiring in our absence. For all of our suspicions that Daravik might pursue us, we had no way of knowing what form that pursuit would take. Now we did. Daravik had leveled Malium from orbit and was hurling the planet's bones after us.
As insults go, Abaddon admitted through clenched teeth, I almost admire the bastard.
He called up to the Amamnesis in her containment chamber. Altio, can we kill that fleet? She had already processed a multitude of estimates and probabilities.
Yes,
she replied, watching the motionless armada that faced us.
Casualties will be catastrophic on both sides, but yes, we can kill them.
Abaddon stared at the oculus, the same calculations firing behind his narrowed eyes.
Daravik can't intend to fight here.
He spoke of the storm's instability around us, but also, I suspect, the fact that our fleets were so evenly matched. Forcing the issue here would be definitive, but practically suicidal.
They have nothing that can match the spirit,
Telemachon urged, as he appeared at Abaddon's side.
We should fight.
And if they cripple half of our fleet while we're beating them? I countered. You ate that Templar's brain the same as I did. You know what lies beyond the Eye's borders. We cannot afford to limp our way out of here with the real battle yet to come. The decision was stolen from us when the Anamnesis laughed, the sound resonating in tinny majesty from her damaged vox gargoyles. She twisted in her blood-streaked fluid, her laughter bitter and dark. A moment later, voices rose from the crew consoles responsible for the vox array.
They are hailing us!
Altio called out over one of the human officers, saying the same thing.
Daravik wishes to meet on neutral ground.
Abaddon added his laughter to the tempest of amusement already taking hold of the bridge.
And what terms does he offer for this truce?
The communications officer in his tattered finery replied, still holding one hand to his earpiece.
You and him, Lord Abaddon, each may bring 10 warriors. You may choose the neutral ground upon which to meet.
Ezekiel was still chuckling.
Tell him I do not need 10 warriors. Inform him that I will bring 3.
Yes, Lord Abaddon.
Abaddon turned amused eyes back to me.
Is something amiss, Kaon?
3 warriors, I asked. My disapproving tone spoke for me.
I am Lord of the Black Legion, he said.
and it was the first time I ever heard him speak those words, naming us as our enemies named us.
No one dictates terms to me. Let the coward bring his 10 for protection. I will bring 3, and we will smile throughout his tawdry truce.
He bared his filed teeth in the ugliest of grins.
And if the chance arises, Kaon,
I want you to kill him.